This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. You see, friends, you make a promise to yourself, I'm going to take off 2 weeks at the end of the year, give myself a little bit of a break, and then you end up breaking your own promise, you know? It's one thing to lie to your family and to your friends, but to yourself, it's quite different. Look, what can I say? Lately, it just seems like all this pleading and begging I'm doing, all this work that I'm doing is starting to pay off, and people are responding, and they're coming on, and it's hard to say no as very much. And so, I mean, it's not even a matter of saying no. There's just so many, recently been so many great people that I've been able to get on the show. I'm going to stop fooling myself. I'll just continue doing this. I make this solemn vow. This is the last show of the year. This is episode 181 of FilmWax Radio. Welcome. Last week, I finally got to put up that Al Maisels. You may have noticed there is some funny kind of audio stuff going on. What happened was, without going into great detail, Al Maisels is really sweet. This one of the sweetest people I know. He's very soft-spoken, as you can tell. So what I had to do is I had to remove the hiss using, you know, this editing software, which had an effect on the speed, and then I tried to fix it. So anyway, I don't know if you're listening that closely or at all, so I apologize for that. I am continuing to work on the sonic side of the show, and it's just a lot of work, and it's going to require me to invest in more equipment, and I hope to do so. But as I mentioned, this is episode 181. We are at the end of the year now. I finally got on a film critic who's an old friend of the show. Brandon Harris has been on a few times. Actually, he's done. It's one of us, a couple of people who's been on more times than the shows have broadcast. So what happened with Brandon is he came on a couple of times. One show was like we get to talking. And it was like really, really long, and I cut it in half, and I always figured I'll put on the other half. This is not that. This is a brand new show, but I still have this half of a conversation with him that I never put up, which I should at some point, except that it really won't be that relevant. And then there was another show which we never put up for reasons I'm not going to go into at the moment. Let's put it that way. We both just sort of mentioned to each other before we recorded the show you're about to hear that we were glad we didn't go with putting the last chat we had up on the podcast. So Brandon's on the second part of this particular episode. The first half is something I'm very excited about. I have been a fan of Jane Addams, the actress, for quite some time. She's first of all, she's adorable. But she's also immensely talented and intelligent. I'm trying to remember the first time she came to my radar, probably with Happiness, Todd Solondz's film. She's probably best known recently for her work on the HBO series Hung, where she plays an unlikely pimp to Thomas Jane's male prostitute. And she got a lot of great notices for that. Jane Addams has done quite a bit of other work as well. She was also a recurring character for a while on Frasier. So maybe now bells are going off. A couple of other films that she has been in is Wonder Boys and Little Children. Just an amazing career. Smart choices. This is also, by the way, the film that we're going to talk about is called All the Light in the Sky. I saw it this past summer at the Northside Festival. And I'd heard some good things about it, and I went to see it, and I really, really loved it. It was made prior to Drinking Buddies, but by Joe Swanberg, but it wasn't released until just now. It's going to be out on this Friday, the 20th, today, in fact. I guess that would be the 20th of December. It's already available, I believe, on various digital platforms. When I say that, that's because I'm not positive which ones, but I'm assuming it's either iTunes or Amazon, perhaps both. But it's such a terrific little movie. It's, yeah, that's all I can say. Just really do try to check it out and support the film. Jane has been on in several of Joe's films, including Alexander the Last, Silver Bullets, and now this one, so All the Light in the Sky. The other guest with Jane is another old friend of the show, Sophia Takal. She is the director of the movie Green. She's also acted in a number of films, including her husband's film, Gabby on the Roof, in July. Here's how incestuous the circles become. Sophia, who is in All the Light in the Sky as well, which is directed by Joe Swanberg, who's appeared on the show on two occasions. She's also been in the film Supporting Characters, directed by Daniel Schechter, who has been a guest on this show. As I mentioned, she directed Green, which also co-starred her husband, Lawrence Michael Levine, who has been on this show. She was acted in VHS, which also starred Calvin Reeder, who has been on this show, and a few other films. Let's just leave it there. Okay, so I'm very happy to have Sophia back on for, I think this is her third visit. Sophia was one of my first guests, as was Brandon. He was an early guest. So I'm very excited to bring them on this, the last episode of the year. Brandon and I, one other thing, Brandon and I do get to talk a little bit of some of our favorite films, which is kind of nice because we don't do technically don't do a top 10, we did get to mention some of our mutually favorite films, mostly what he thought was best, and I just sort of said, yeah, I agree, you know, because he's the critic in the family. Anyway, all that is coming up in just a moment. This is, again, episode 181 Film Wax Radio. And here we go to my conversation with Ms. Jane Addams and Ms. Sophia Takal.
I mean, unfortunately, on the Fox movie, it's not going to happen because they made it all through somebody else.
Who was it?
I think it's Kristen Wiig. I'm trying to find out.
Oh, right. No, that makes sense.
Dr. T?
It seemed like everybody else was already really successful, and I was this broke, like, girl from New York with, you know, ripped jeans and my dad's overcoat.
How about if you say, I have 45 years to draw upon. Every incident that I'm in, it's not like, whoa, I'm 45, can I still do this? It's like, I have 45 years worth of experience to meet this brand new experience. And I have all 45 years worth of colors and rain, you know, everything to be in this moment. You know, whether it's like doing the most boring thing or the greatest adventure you're on, right? Why don't people think of that? I now own 45, I have in here. Instead, they're like, yeah, I'm 45.
Admit your ignorance mic.
Here,
though.
I'll admit it into the mic.
Thank you.
I know nothing about Brooklyn. I have about it. I went out there yesterday to a party, and I was like, I didn't know which way. I don't know. I just know I was in Brooklyn.
You were brought
it
there.
It was beautiful. I was brought there. I went out on the train to go to a brunch at someone's. I could have been anywhere.
But you got on a train. Do you remember the subway stop you got off? You were with somebody and they did the...
I don't pay attention to those
things. So you were with somebody. You were with somebody and they did that.
Exactly.
Okay. So
you know
just...
how that can happen if someone else yes. knows where you just go into autopilot and
oh, sure.
chat with people
yeah.
and then suddenly you're at a brunch.
Oh, sure.
And you're in Brooklyn, but you don't know where.
Babies are.
But so many babies.
Because you were probably in my neighborhood. Because there's only babies in Brooklyn.
I had to leave. I had to leave. And I like children, but I had to leave this brunch because there were too many
babies
and too many children. It was too much. I was overwhelmed. And also none of the adults could have a conversation.
Did you just say the reason you were leaving?
I said, I have to go. There are too many children here. I mean, but I stayed for a while, but then I did leave earlier than I would have.
Right.
If it was too much. The children had taken over.
The children have taken over Brooklyn. When people talk about how Greenpoint is the young part of Brooklyn, they're wrong. It's actually all the parts where there's actually babies.
Toddlers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
those are the real young people. Exactly.
Yeah,
because these were like also... There were 6-year-olds and 5-year-olds that were like teenagers.
Totally.
They're just, they...
At a certain point, people started bringing them everywhere. Bars. There's so many babies at bars that there are signs in bars that say no babies after 8 p.m.
That's
I'm not
funny.
Even kidding.
That's bizarre.
Yeah.
Oh. That's bizarre. Clearly, things are out of control.
Maybe I'll get a t-shirt that says no babies.
After 8 p.m.
So you were at a party yesterday in Brooklyn and... Somewhere in Brooklyn. Okay.
Somewhere.
Where do you call home?
Malibu, California.
Okay. Very good. One of an
Far.
Actor that you know, I think. Do you know Chris Dubeck? He was at the park. Yeah. Mentioned I should mention Relativity during the conversation.
Oh,
also,
my
that,
God. Was he in it?
No.
Okay.
He just thought that for some reason he said it was a very good series.
Yeah.
And that
was.
You would like talk maybe to, you know, that would be good to bring up.
That's
and that,
it. He's... Good friend, right? He's a friend.
Yeah,
he's wise and a good friend. Because yeah, it was. I was working with Adam Goldberg. I mean, was working with a lot of fun actors, but Adam was cast as kind of my love interest, and that was I was 28 years old or something, 29
wow.
years old. So your friend has a good memory too.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Ed Zwick and Marshall Hershkovitz produced that.
30 something.
Yeah. So
right,
this show, it's short lived. Life, it was kind of known as 20-something.
I see.
And it taught me a lot. It's why I got happiness. It's why Ted Hope later said, well, that pushed it over the, you know, we were casting, and then it was like I had read, but then they saw an episode of Relativity.
Wow.
Who knew?
So that was great, and then you had to unfortunately work with Todd Solondz. That must have been hell.
It was wonderful. That was what a great experience. Yeah, I'm like,
I'm
no,
sorry.
But I just sort of,
we're
going
to get to
that's me going, okay, enough about me.
It's an interview. What are you talking about?
No,
we'll get to Sophia.
Okay,
of course. I love Sophia. But it's because, it was because of, well, I've been a fan. I've seen a number of things that you've been in, but I had Joe Swanberg on here a couple of times. Sophia's been on.
I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. Todd was on. I think you're both.
I have a feeling he's up the notch already, even before he walked.
I'm saying an extra notch.
Right. You can't go too many notches.
Oh, sure you can.
So there's never
just,
in the end to the quality. It is a work in progress. So, I saw all the light in the sky.
Then you get so many notches on your belt that you break the belt buckle. That's what just happened a couple days ago. I don't know. Yeah.
What the?
This piece is missing right here. See?
Yes, the loop. That would go through.
That's what happens.
Can we just note for those listening that Jane just lifted up her shirt and we saw a little bit of skin?
I was trying to play cool. Trying to play cool. I got flashed. It's okay. I'm going to do that myself in a minute. I'm not going to quite
I'm just saying everyone else is missing out, and maybe this should be a web episode.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Let's
take a look.
What did they say?
Okay, so I'm going to do one thing. I'm going to take charge a little bit. It's been a little bit. You guys are giddy. I'm giddy to be here with you both. It's really wonderful to have Jane and Sophia both on the show. But... All the Light and Sky, I saw it at the Northside Film Festival. I don't know if you know, that's where it had its New York premiere. And after just having seen Drinking Buddies not long before, I really wasn't expecting a whole lot. I mean, I didn't know. And then I just saw it and I saw it. I like this even better than Drinking Buddies.
Oh, I love you.
I love this film.
And I love Drinking Buddies.
Right. I did too. Not,
yeah. But I love that you love this film too.
I thought this was such a special film. In other words, I thought Drinking Buddies for me was like, oh, Joe really needed to do a film like that, I thought, especially right at this time and place. It was perfect film for him to do. It's a great film. It's not predictable. Then it's like this other film, which is it's just so, it's, you know, it's maybe an overused term, but poetic. You know, there's so many layers to it, which is really, I was blown away by it. I really was. So I was very impressed. From the moment I saw it, I thought, I really want to, you know, make sure people try to help so
Great.
People see it and know about it, you know.
Good.
Yeah. And I just thought, this is great. Let me get, you know, you guys on here. So that's the backstory. So the film, though, why don't you give a little bit of a synopsis? Or Sophia, do you want to give a little synopsis about the film?
I really want you to. Do you mind?
This is good. She's going to read them.
No, please.
You're reading the notes. I'm going to start you off, okay?
Well,
and you talk about your character a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay? Faye.
So I play Faye, Jane's character, Marie's niece, and I'm a young actress who's in L.A. to meet with a director, perhaps more than just a director. Anyway, I can't tell if I'm there, like, auditioning and meeting agents and stuff, or if I'm just there to meet Ty. In my brain, I was there for more than just that.
Right.
And I'm staying with my favorite aunt / wonderful actress aunt, Marie.
Yeah. And so then Sophia, my niece, shows up, and the character of Marie hasn't been working as much as she used to when she was at Sophia's age or your character's, Faye's age. And my niece coming into to my life at that juncture forces a kind of re-examining of, you know, my life, which then unfolds in that by the end of the film, my character has had to face some things that she wouldn't have had to face had the niece not shown up. You know, just that thing where you don't have to look at yourself until there's someone else around that also sees. Because you see the relationship with Larry and, you know.
Yeah.
And then I think her character also sees. It's funny that it is the two Larrys. I never really. That is a little bit wild that your character is involved with a character played by an actor named Larry. I like to think that you guys got married, you and Larry, because of the movie.
I know.
I like to think that. You don't have to say it's not true. We'll just
it's not.
Let me.
No, it is true. That's what I meant. It's not true.
There's a degree of the. Did it have an effect?
It did have desired effect of getting married.
I like hearing that.
Yeah,
that's significant, right?
We were already engaged, but we'd been engaged for like 5 years. So I feel like this was. From this and said, "I want to get married. Let's set a date."
I'm ready to, you can just shoot me now because like, that's all that's why you make art is to affect people. And we had another young woman asking us some questions and it made me really happy that she was saying she hadn't seen a film where she was expecting that somehow the relationship was going to turn somehow, that something bad was going to happen because you don't see movies where an older woman and a younger woman actually support each other. And so that makes me happy.
Because Jane supports me.
Yeah. In life. In art and in life.
Right. And I think a typical device could have been used that you would have felt very threatened by Faye, the character Faye.
Right. Or she would have had an affair with Larry's character and it would have been like, oh my God. Or Lindsay's character would have freaked out because her boyfriend started dating me. You know?
Like, yeah.
All of the stuff.
I love that sort of like, not just that your character, an older woman's not threatened by a younger woman, but that like these like cliches of like older men leaving older women for younger women. There's that one relationship.
Yeah. The one time.
And then, you know, whatever happens with that happens, but still it's cool for them. So I'm sorry.
For 5 minutes.
I got really in my head about ruining the whole movie.
I found myself really, I found that your character of, shit, Marie, thank you.
I know, I couldn't. Don't worry. Because no, we couldn't remember while we were shooting. None of us can remember our names. Yeah. There was a scene that we were shooting, and I kept coming out, and Kent and I, we didn't know what our names were. Like,
really?
Four and our, yeah.
You're all stoned. Just, come on.
No, he was.
Oh, Kent was. Kent, let's bring.
I was not.
Kent is plays a role of he's like in the group of.
Yeah. What is his name? I can't remember.
Doesn't
now.
Matter. But he, but this was Kent of Uncle Kent, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think it's the same character? Like a spinoff? Or what's the equivalent of a spinoff where, like, one character goes into another character's world? Does that happen in movies?
I don't know.
It'd be like Cinderella being in Snow White.
The same filmmaker?
Yeah.
It's happening now with Hal Hartley's films, like Thagrim and... that whole, there's like two different films. He had one character going between. And I have a feeling what about Todd's? No.
Well, Todd,
those two movies,
now,
Happiness and Life During Wartime.
Todd took it to an extreme, and it's like totally different actors. Even I know. In the middle of the same movie. You know, like in Palindromes, right?
Right.
Isn't there?
Maybe so.
You know, like it's, no, it, for sure, yeah, it starts off like one actress, and then it's like.
But he's not the first to do that. I think Bunuel did that. Sorry.
Sure.
You know, but I think he did.
Yeah,
right? During the Diary of a Chambermaid, I think. There were two actresses. No. I distinctly think you're challenging my knowledge of films. And, you know, I have to. It's rare that I actually can remember the movie, but I think it was the Diary of a Chambermaid.
It seems like the kind of thing that would happen in a Judd Apatow franchise, where, like, Uncle Kent would show up in All the Light in the Sky.
Maybe.
Like, Paul Rudd playing a character.
Right.
Oh, that is what they did with This Is 40. Sorry. That's why it sounds familiar, right?
Yeah.
You can hashtag This Is 40 and people will click on this.
Okay. That's it. I need you for social media.
Yeah, Sophia keeps us hip.
So what was it coming onto this particular set? It seems so out of the typical Swamberg. You've done how many? Two? This is your second or third Swamberg?
Is it three?
Film.
Three.
You did, right? Because you did Art History and Silver Linings?
No. I showed up to shoot. We met in 2008 in July because I showed up to shoot Alexander the Last.
I was playing that director
in the thing. And then we knew we wanted to keep working together in 5 minutes.
Why?
I think really it's because both of us are from the Midwest. We both grew up in Illinois. That, I don't know, I always have that kind of thing happen, or often I've met someone and we have an instant thing, and then we find out we both grew up in Illinois or Indiana or something. And then we the way he was shooting, like within 10 minutes he was shooting something and I was kneeling down on the floor doing something, and I was wearing like a blue t-shirt or something, and he said and he had the camera on his shoulder and he's shooting, and then he stops and he turns off the camera. He's like, okay, listen, Jane, can you just take your shirt off, turn it inside out, and put it back on, because I want to shoot this as if it's another day. So it was like an instant costume change, but it was so effortless and so like, well, let's just do this thing, like get whatever I need done, that I looked at him and I said, oh, we have to keep working together.
Yeah.
And he said, I know. And I'll never forget this, because it was, we honestly had known each other for all of like 15 minutes. And he said, I know, I'm going to come back out and we'll make another film. And I said, good. And he said, I'm going to come in November. And he did. So it was like a few months later, there he was with his camera and his backpack of, you know, his computer and some sound equipment. And then we started shooting.
Yeah.
That became Silver Bullets. So that was our second experience.
Right.
But while we were shooting Silver Bullets, we shot a bunch of scenes with Kate Scheel, who's so wonderful, that were kind of like, in retrospect, I look back and it was like, that was less workshopping All the Light in the Sky, in a way.
Mm.
Because those scenes didn't end up in Silver Bullets, but they were what they ended up
They're
in
They're kind
All
of
the
a
Light
catalyst for, that's interesting.
Yeah, similar, you know, like they were the seed. Of like, it was us trying to work out that idea of, okay, there's a young woman and an older woman, and except Kate wasn't playing my niece. And I think that was the conceit that helped us. In a way, I mean it when I say workshop, because what we discovered is that it needed to be a relationship that would be so comfortable, where you could cut right to talking about whatever you wanted to talk about. So then it was the aunt and niece thing works really well for that.
Mm. And so you felt immediately a sort of a at least artistically, a kind of kinship with Joe Swanberg when that happened.
Right away.
And what was your experience, Sophia, working originally with him?
I also really love Sophia in The Zone that Joe directed. I think she's so wonderful in that. Mm-hmm. And so I want to hear.
Well, I met Joe through Kate Scheel because Kate was living with us and they were still shooting Silver Bullets by the time she was living with us. And he would stay at our house because we had a couch. And then I guess something about the dynamic of my Larry and Kate and me living all in one house gave him the idea for The Zone.
Right.
So it was the first time I really worked with him. But I had been such a fan of his work since college. I actually just read my college thesis, which was about DIY cinema.
Really?
And it was about the puffy chair and Hannah Takes the Stairs. It's kind of embarrassing.
No.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was really into it and really wanted to be a part of that group of, I really thought that that would be a great place to,
and you made
those would be great people. Yeah, I mean, I didn't actively make it happen. I didn't get in touch with any of them or anything. We met, had a
talking to Deepak Chopra is wrong when he says, you can manifest anything.
Oh yeah, I really feel like
just think about what you want to visualize.
I feel like I manifested this group of.
By the way, that was not Deepak on the show.
And then, I 2011, which is when we shot All the Light in the Sky, is actually Joe and I at one point realized that every other month we had worked together on something, either as actors or as him directing me. So 2011 was the year of Joe Swanberg. And at the end of 2011, I got an email from Joe asking if I wanted to play Jane's niece. And I said earlier to Jane, I had actually committed to doing another movie at the time. And I dropped out. I was just I can't.
No,
I have to do this.
Right.
What
did,
yes.
you knew her work and
yeah, and I think she's the best.
Yeah.
There is. So
I didn't
please.
Know any of that. I didn't know any of that until just now.
Also, Joe is someone, I don't know if you feel this way. It'd be interesting to know how you feel, but Joe is someone who, for whatever reason, he's very much a director to me in that you want his approval so badly. I'm just anytime I'm working with him, I feel really comfortable, but I'm just I just really want Joe to like me. I just really want him to think that I'm good. And for
that's you though, that you have that in general.
That's definitely true. Yeah.
I mean, I've had it with other people. I've had that feeling. I just don't have that with Joe, but I think it's just because I'm flinty and old at this point in my life. And I don't, it's different. It's just a different relationship.
Yeah, it's a different relationship.
But I understand.
But
and
then when
about.
He asked me to do this, I was like, it felt like, I was like, yeah, Joe likes me. He could have asked anyone to do this. I feel really lucky.
See, this is also why he cast you, because you're so honest. See, the, you know, one thing that Joe said to me when he said, he told me that you guys were coming over, but I didn't know your work. I didn't know anything. I was distracted by some other things, and I knew I was going to like whoever he brought over, so it didn't concern me. So one thing he said to me is, Sophia will be free to talk about whatever comes up. Sophia will honestly talk about whatever comes up. And I thought that was he couldn't really have paid you a higher compliment than that.
That's
a beautiful thing to say about someone. And I'm reminded of that right now. Cause you do, you say things and I think, really, are you sure? There's this part of my brain going are you sure you want to reveal all that? why would you,
It's refreshing. And, not to be, have been, to be working in New York too, in this particular period of time with these types of filmmakers, and not to have to squelch down as much as kind of you have to on a social level, maybe working in a more conventional film set or environment.
Well, when Sophia says, there's a great scene in that I love her in All the Light in the Sky. And she says, we're talking about having children, and she says something about that it's about attention. she says. And I remember at the time having the same feeling I just had right now. Like, even though the camera was rolling and we were making the film, I thought, does she really want to, like, say that? I feel like, okay. And it's so wonderful because there is so much truth to that, but it's not necessarily flattering. It's not, you know.
Always welcome.
It's just the truth. Yeah.
No, but. In this case.
No, like, I mean, not a lot of women would feel comfortable admitting that there's an element of that to wanting to.
I think part of that is also Joe, like, so many times when I've done scenes, I'm just like, wait, we just filmed that? What? No, that's not what I want you to use. Like, I want to polish this. But, you know, I think that, like, he also makes me feel really comfortable to be honest. Because he's really non-judgmental.
Yeah, he is. He's very not... He's not a judgy person. Yeah.
Sounds like there's two things that go on the set. And one is a level of trust that he establishes with you guys, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing is he puts his artistic choices ahead of all else. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's like, even if it doesn't always mean it will be maybe commercially successful or...
Well, this is...
I don't know. Whatever it is.
It's exactly right what you're saying. And it's part of why we knew in 10 minutes that we wanted to be working together. Because I could tell... And I had been looking for someone like this to work with. He didn't care what the end result was. It was more about, like, are we having fun now? Not just fun, but you know what I mean? Like, is
making
this,
something
is,
special happen.
Is something happening now that's interesting? Yes. Okay, then fine. Like, we'll just keep going with that. That's what I meant about the episode about, like, can you switch your shirt around? Because I'm going to... Because I knew... Oh, he sees that whatever we're doing right now is so interesting that he wants to keep shooting it and then just act in the movie like it's a different day. Because whatever we're into right now, I don't even remember what it was, but it was interesting. And so there was less of a, he wasn't concerned like, well, this isn't what I imagined I was going to be shooting. And, you know, this is deviating from the script or something. Mm-hmm. This is like, he was just interested in it. And while we were shooting Silver Bullets, as I said, I shot all these scenes with Kate, and we kind of knew, like, this movie, I just knew it's likely that this isn't going to be a movie that I'm going to be, I didn't even think I would be in it at all, like, in the end. Like, it wouldn't have surprised me of Silver Bullets if I had been cut completely. Like, it did, and my point is, it didn't matter to me, because the process itself is what I was signing up for. Like, I just like... working with him. And like, if we had shot for another, you know, 6 days, like say we had shot a total of 12 days that December, All the Light in the Sky, and then Joe had said, well, I can't really, and I don't know, you know, like that, it was more, we knew, so I knew it was going to end up, you know, being a movie. But Joe also had to be strict with me because I have a tendency to, like, I remember one time we were shooting something and I kind of like was pulling Lindsay into the thing, and Joe said to me, I'll never forget this, because he was like, no, Jane, this is your movie, you are the center of this film, like, he would not let
own it,
me
baby.
Let it
own it,
yeah, like,
right, yeah.
So I owe that to him.
You mentioned you live in Malibu, and I was wondering, where are you a surfer?
I'm not a surfer, but I have friends. But I have a lot of friends that are surfers.
Yeah.
I do the stand up paddle thing that you see me do in the movie. I really enjoy that.
That's not a stunt person.
Yeah.
Did you get on there too? Did you?
No, she wouldn't.
No, I'm afraid of the ocean.
She's afraid of the ocean.
Huh. Fish.
Really sad.
No. Usually, anytime I go into the ocean, I end up getting sucked under by the waves, and I'm, like, afraid of drowning.
And those waves are pretty intense.
That's not unusual. The fear of drowning is good, because it's less likely you'll drown.
But, yeah, when you go out on those stand-up paddle boards, on a regular day, there are dolphins swim with you. And
oh, my gosh.
I mean, I have that experience a lot. Like, Amy Simons and I went out on one of those boards in January and saw a whale.
Whale,
and I'm not exaggerating or making this up. It was 20 feet away from us, a gray whale, and that happens. Like, people who live there will tell you that happens. Like, I have friends who have pictures that their friends took on the coastline watching them, where you can see a whale, you know, and them on their board. And that, but so Amy and I were out there, and I looked, because I looked at her face, went, oh, you know, and then I looked over, and there was a big gray whale.
And he was like, there's Jane Addams and Amy Simons.
I'm going to get sad. I just started thinking about how sad it is that there's not going to be as many whales because of the ocean, which reminds me of the climate change part
aspect
of
all the
movie.
The way in the sky, yeah.
Talk about
that's
it,
a
great subplot, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there's a metaphor there, too. Yeah.
The first time
we're all growing old and also we grow old, but also the
that
oceans.
Scene with you and David, I didn't even know it existed in the movie until we saw it at AFI, and I was just like, this is the best scene ever to exist. Is it the last? It's almost the last.
I think it is almost the last scene.
And it's Jane develops a relationship with a solar engineer because mm-hmm. she's researching a part, and he sits with her and talks about climate change and how the sun is a middle-aged star, and it's just a very, as you said, poetic metaphor for what aging as a human is like as well. He likens aging as a human to like the earth and sun
yeah.
getting older.
Which is really all it is.
We have to wrap
light.
It.
You know, we're just made up of water and light. That's it.
I always find it's amazing that 75% of the, I mean, this is very basic, but 75% of the world, the earth is water, and 75% of humans are water, so there's
exactly.
got to be.
Exactly.
I mean,
see?
There are a lot of other, I know.
There's nothing else going on. There's nothing else going on.
Right, yeah. Or just drinks of water.
I know, but
around.
I don't know why everyone's so afraid of death, because we don't know what this is. Like, look at us right now. What the hell is going on? I don't know. There's red microphones and. She knows. I always, it's like
you
eyeballs.
Think along those existential
always.
Lines all the time. You think existentially.
It's yeah. hard to live.
It is hard because it's like you're, if you're questioning, why are we pretending? What are these pretenses?
The fact that everyone pulls off pretending to understand what's happening and like make sense of it all right, this is what we need to do. And like, look at it. We don't know. I don't know what any of this is about, but here we are.
Nevertheless.
Yeah.
Going through
and
the motions
so
on some.
Interested in that. So.
Well, those very questions or issues, I agree. I just wanted to. I know I'm going to have to fucking wind down in a minute, which is too bad. But.
Are you going to the bathroom?
No.
Oh.
I guess but I did want to say the scenes. Very compelling component. Of the movie of All the Light in the Sky, which, by the way, is currently available digitally, I believe, on iTunes, probably in Amazon,
oh, yeah.
and opening in New York
in the Village, right?
on the 20th.
Friday.
Yeah, on this Friday. And also is already, I think, playing in Chicago, right? Am I wrong?
Yeah, right?
Makes
yeah.
sense if it were. But that the scenes with you and Larry Fessenden
yeah.
are really, really, really touching, very intimate.
Oh, good.
Incredibly honest, yet cinematic too.
Like, oh, good!
And, you know, his impression of Jack Nicholson, maybe that helps that. But
it's great, right?
It's amazing. You know,
did I tell you about how? Sorry, I know you.
No.
Okay. When I came home, I was like, Larry Fessenden just did a crazy. Like, I think he might be related to Jack Nicholson. And we went on his Wikipedia page, and it said he is the illegitimate son of Jack Nicholson. It's gone now. It was a joke someone did.
It's
but
a good
it's
joke.
It's so. Spot
it
on.
It's a great impersonation.
Yeah, it's spot on. Is right. Well, we could just go on, but I feel. I just wanted to also point that out. You know, if you had a response to that chemistry you guys created. That again.
Oh, Larry.
That was,
well, we had that. We had a few scenes in Silver Bullets, and there was a lot of. Chemistry there, and so it didn't surprise me when Joe said, "I want to bring Larry out to play." It was like, "Well, of course, Larry." Larry's just really smart and funny and generous person, and Joe understands that, and I get it, and he's wonderful to work with. So I don't know, but I can't. I don't know. It's a mystery what makes that work.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
But but he's just a brilliant man, so it doesn't surprise me that he and Larry also is a real supporter of, you know, young artists. Like didn't he produce Ty's stuff at first too, Ty West? And was he a producer of Joe's at some point too, or are they just friends? I don't know.
I don't know if he produced shows, but he did work on Ties and a lot of he's supportive
and all that stuff.
Supporter.
Right. Oh yeah. So I really would love to also. I got to get that guy. Larry,
you got to.
I got to get him on this. Yeah,
definitely.
I think that Zen.
Larry Fessenden, ladies and gentlemen.
Right, look him up.
Yeah.
Or better yet, just go see All the Light in the Sky. You'll see him in action.
You can see Larry in All the Light in the Sky on Friday night at Cinema Village.
Jane Addams, Sophia Tikal, thank you very much for coming on and being so entertaining and lovely.
Thank you.
Oh, that was a pleasure. Okay, well, Brandon invited me out to his home in Bed-Stuy. It was only fitting, as he is kind of embedding his more of his circumstances where he lives and the films he sees and his life and in his writing and in his work. So it was a pleasure to just sort of sit in his living room with him and have another chat with Brandon. Brandon is writes for a bunch of journals, but we pretty much cover it all. I don't want to really go on anymore. My conversation with the one and only Brandon Harris.
Abdallah's Rags and Tatters, magnificent movie, and Kimi Takatsui's. Am I pronouncing that right? I don't know. Her new film, Looking for Adventure, which is a featurette.
Okay.
That was at Mar del Plata.
Does that mean like a not a short, not a feature?
Yes.
Okay. Like a novella.
Indeed.
Not a short story.
I wish more people made them. I'm hoping now that we've entered this era of like VOD and stuff that people will get so used to watching episodic television that they'll be open to non-traditional cinematic forms. Because when I think of like television, I think of pretty straight narrative storytelling strategies. You know, things that would be at home in, say, a Howard Hawks movie. That's the aesthetic of television. I mean, there are other examples, you know, of maybe some slightly more adventurous television, even amongst, you know, TV that we could say, you know, is you know, kind of interesting on the basis of plot and character and story, and acting and craftsmanship in that way. Mm-hmm. But there, I still think, as Richard Brody pointed out in his end of the year blog post, I don't know if you caught that.
Which
but,
one?
Richard Brody from The New Yorker.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The front row.
Not yet.
But he talks about how, despite the rise of sophisticated television, if you will, especially on the non-premium cable networks, and on HBO and stuff, but that despite that, the really interesting aesthetic stuff is still to be found in dark rooms. Mm-hmm. You know, with lots of people in them, eating
sticky popcorn.
Sticky popcorn. The nice theaters have like coffee and stuff. Yeah. You know, like coffee and booze and.
Right. Yeah.
That's, they put duck fat in the popcorn.
That's right. That's true. They used to, when there was that option.
Yeah. We no more ducks though, so we can't put duck fat on popcorn anymore.
Are they
global warming has killed all the ducks?
Has it?
Soon.
News to me. But that, yeah, that's it's called First Look.
First Look, yes, First Look, yeah. The First Look series. I think this is their third year, and it's an impressive lineup. That, you know, they're culling a lot of stuff that doesn't get here during the calendar year. That goes all the way back to like Rotterdam, 2013, to Berlin, and then you know festivals throughout the fall and winter, Mar del Plata and Venice. And, and then, you know, kind of really off the beaten track stuff.
Yeah. One that this is the First Look film series, which is going to take place at the Museum of the Moving Image. And I think in January some point. So we'll have David Schwartz on, probably. But one of the films that I also noticed in there, well, there were two Ape, which is, you know, one of Matt Grady's films. Also, Alexander Rockwell.
Yes.
Who has not been...
Very curious to see that.
Yeah, me too.
Was that at Slam Dance last year?
Oh, I don't know. It's very possible. I don't know. I was.
Or maybe that was in Venice and no one...
Oh, really?
Or Toronto or something.
I'm sure it says it in the press notes, but... That's an interesting guy who's...
Absolutely. Never a really... key figure in the early nascent days of studio-supported indie filmmaking.
Yeah. The Miramax...
The early Miramax, end of the Island Pictures, end of Fine Line.
Yeah, Fine Line, and when all the studios had their little boutique.
Right, but even before that, I think he made his mark in 92.
Before they realized there was a money to be made for a year.
Right, I mean, he was kind of coming along in that era when it was still, there was still some pioneer aspect to it.
Yeah.
There was still a Missouri for independent films, referencing the Howard Hawks movie that's on right now. You know, there was still this uncharted territory or the possibility of there being...
But that's the kind of guy I'd like to get on, because also like a Rockwell, because I'm curious like his story, and it's probably a really good story. It maybe not, but I'm thinking it probably would be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on? And you were doing a lot more writing...
Although
I guess that's not... I don't know. You've been doing it for...
I guess... I don't think I'm doing a lot more writing. No. I'm writing different things.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Maybe.
Right.
No, I'm doing a lot of writing, but I'm writing different things.
What's your... we can get into a couple of specific articles that you're more excited about, surely, but I'm kind of curious what your approach is, and what's your ritual like, if you have one. What do you do to remain productive? And also... As a second question, how much do you pitch versus how much are you, solicited, I guess, for your writing?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's definitely a situation where I'm increasingly trying to do long form stuff that isn't maybe traditional movie criticism. So, you know, for instance, years ago I wrote for Spot Blog, and I had a blog called Cinema Echo Chamber. And because I was my own editor at one, and I had a fairly adventurous editor at the other, at least for the first couple of years I was doing it, I think I could go and write about something in a fairly non-traditional way without having to ask. But increasingly, as I became more of like an actual professional journalist... a filmmaker, and then doing a lot of freelancing at IndieWire and Variety and Moving Pictures Magazine and, you know, three or four other, like, film publications, film-centric publications. That's very assignment-based. It's like, go to this film festival and write about the festival, or write about this film, write a review that's, 800 words of the film, or interview this person, or a person every week, which is what I've been doing at Filmmaker for the better part of 4 years. So over 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. And, right now, I've had kind of a flurry of pieces, in kind of more.
A flurry of snowflakes.
Snowflakes. Giant snowflakes.
Referencing the weather. Referencing the weather and Errol Morris in one
in some
sense.
In some places where that aren't necessarily film centric. So, for instance, I have a piece in the new issue of N Plus One. Good News is the name of that issue 18, and that's called Bed-Stuy, and it's about the neighborhood we're recording this very conversation at, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. And my experience is being a young cineast, trying to make my way in the world. And my relationship with my first roommate in Bed-Stuy. Actually, my second roommate in Bed-Stuy. But that's kind of part of what the essay is about, is that no one knows when they live in Bed-Stuy these days. Do you live in Bed-Stuy or don't you? Does the internet tell you the truth about where you live?
Oh, I see. Well, yes. The internet has conspired with the realtors, and now indeed, you may be living in any number of fancy sound.
Neighborhoods are invented. Streets become neighborhoods they never have been before.
The word hills.
Hills gets attached to things.
Yeah. Usually hill is a big one.
It's fascinating how that works. But the funny, there's a lot of, you know, like film and cultural criticism in there too, though. I mean, I talk extensively about Spike Lee's Central Brooklyn films. So not his entire oeuvre, but films like Joe's Bedside Barbershop, for instance, or Clockers, or Do the Right Thing, obviously.
Yeah.
Crooklyn. The films that are set more or less in and around here, really, and kind of are touchstones that were very local for me, you know, in that
I
described going down the street that Do the Right Thing was shot on.
Yeah.
Which is very, very close to here.
Is it?
Stuyvesant between Lexington and Quincy. And, excuse me. Lexington between Stuyvesant and Quincy. And,
goodness, we didn't,
I know, we'll get letters that now. And just how that block is barren during the middle of the summer. Like that notion of a, you know, multicultural, bustling block filled with, teeming with racial tension was but a fantasy. You know, that when I encounter young men who are about the age Martin Lawrence is in that movie on that block, and I ask them, do you know Do the Right Thing was shot here? They have no idea what I'm talking about.
That is sad. Not that the block is empty, but I mean, of course, that's sad in a different way. But I don't think wouldn't have expectations that the block should somehow carry on the. It's a cultural touchstone for many people.
Right.
That film. So I understand the emotional connection, and maybe there should be a plaque or a park or a statue.
There was. It was taken, actually.
Oh my God! Well, that
used
that
to exist,
tragic.
But it's not there anymore. But you know what's interesting is that the neighborhood in Spike's film, I believe, resembles more the middle class, liberal, progressive neighborhood that Spike grew up in, and lived in, and where his office was, and where his father still lives, Fort Greene.
Fort Greene. I thought he grew up also at Cobble Hill. Did his mother live there or something?
His father lived in Fort Greene.
Okay.
And he's the brownstone that more or less is what Crooklyn imagines. Is on the northeastern side of Fort Greene Park. And his father still lives there. There's actually a story about him in the New York Times recently because he's getting noise complaints from his new neighbors. Because he plays
that
jazz.
That damn jazz music he plays.
Late at night.
He's got to get it beginning 70s. On, huh?
He's well into his 70s.
Oh. Well.
He might be in his early 80s even.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that... The cultural figures that have most maybe been found their way into the public's consciousness when we think of Bed-Stuy, who are artists, are in fact gentrifiers just like my roommate and I were, you know. And so, that's kind of what the essay is getting at. Like someone like the Notorious B.I.G., for instance, who's also very, very much associated with the neighborhood and for years dealt crack both near the JMZ train on the eastern side of the neighborhood and near the Bushwick border, and also on Nostrand Avenue, which is also where his very earliest attempts at rapping took place. He lived in Clinton Hill. So he actually isn't from Bed-Stuy. He was from the nicer
part. That's where
he
worked. He worked in Bed-Stuy.
He worked in Bed-Stuy.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Right. So he commuted.
Indeed. But, you know, it's a reflection on all of these things. You know, the home that Crooklyn was shot in, which is at 7 Arlington Place in Bed-Stuy.
Thank you.
It just recently sold for $1.7 million. And I don't know any black jazz musicians, even with a hit record, who are affording $1.7 million in mortgage. I don't know. So, yeah, that's one thing. And then, obviously, I have, been continuing to do any number of journalistic projects for Filmmaker, the festival criticism and interviews and whatnot. But I'm very excited about this new column I have at the New Inquiry called Aspect Ratio, where I will be examining films, usually stuff that's playing in New York, pegged to festival screenings or commercial openings. But I think in a slightly more conceptual manner than you find
In typical criticism.
So
did you start that yet? Did you have it written?
Yes. The first edition came out 2 weeks ago, and it is about two films that opened in late November that are coincidentally about very well-known, if that's even possible, very well-known philosophers, contemporary philosophers.
I guess one is the tall man happy?
Yes. Noam Chomsky talking to Michel Gondry, and Michel Gondry animating over this conversation and kind of expanding upon the themes and concepts that Chomsky talks about through through his own, you know, very peculiar and sort of charming animated aesthetic. It's a really magnificent movie, very unusual film, and one that sticks with you, I think. And one that I think elucidates some concepts about language and the universality of grammar and of the ways in which we learn speech, as well as touching on Chomsky's political beliefs, but not so much.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then comparing that film to the Slavoj Žižek, Sophie Fiennes film, their second film together, The Pervert's Guide to Cinema, which is the follow-up to The Pervert's Guide to Ideology. And that film, I think it's an interesting analog to the Chomsky film, because Chomsky is very much finds Žižek's ideas fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
And not just Žižek, but the entire kind of French and German post-structuralist tradition. Foucault and on and on.
Lacan. Žižek had a chance to... Žižek was the one who criticized Gondry, is that what...
No. Chomsky criticized Žižek.
Oh, Chomsky himself. Okay.
Yes, Chomsky himself.
I see. Right, right, right.
So did gave an interview to Veterans Unplugged.
Ah, yes. Well, my subscription lapsed, but
in December of last year, and he had some choice words about Žižek and Lacan, who is, of course, you know, kind of the basis for a lot of Žižek's film writing and psychoanalytic film theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I talk about that in those two films.
Mm-hmm.
In the New Inquiry, and you can look for that once a month. That'll be in the print edition of the New Inquiry as well as on the web.
Oh, nice. Okay.
On a monthly basis.
A monthly basis. Okay.
Yes.
So what is your approach to now that we know some of your new articles? What is your approach to, and how do you do it? Because I'm kind of curious. For me, it's always, anytime I tried to write, it's always been a fairly painstaking process. Like, I'll do anything not to do, but once I'm in it, okay, we're good.
It's hard to start.
Yeah.
It's very hard to start.
So it's not just me.
It's very easy to clean your home or
yeah,
watch a movie or write an email or do something more salacious than write.
Yes, right.
And you have to understand that that's a natural thing. And you have to create time for yourself to get past that. I think routines help. A lot of writers talk about writing first thing in the morning, which is how you should exercise, really. If you want to, you know, tone up or lose weight or something, it's like best to get your metabolism going early.
Mm-hmm.
I think the same is true for writing. I'm a big, earnest believer of like waking up and immediately starting. Always do that.
No,
I often fail.
Right. But I think there's something to having cleared out the mind from the sleeping / dreaming process seems to be a way of cleaning out clutter that you're grappling with, and you know, relatively speaking, and then you're, you know, I think it's probably the most prime to focus like on maybe, you know, new thoughts and how to put together some of these ideas at that point in the day before things start catching up with you, you know, the whole new day of that. So I can see why the first getting up early and doing that is productive.
And I think another key thing is to stay aware of a lot of things. And I know that's vague, but...
No, not really.
I think as a critic, especially.
Yeah.
Now, there's something to be said about not being aware of a lot of things when you're, say, a memoirist. When you're, like, digging deep into your own memory. And that's what you're doing.
Mm.
But...
Excavation,
right.
Yeah.
You kind of want to focus on yourself and on the past and not so much on the breadth of what's going on now. But as a critic, I think it's really important to be able to place a work in the context in which it's being received, in which it's being offered.
Mm.
It's important to know who the author is or authors. You know, so and so I th- and so I think yeah. it's to finish that point. I think it's important to encounter a lot of things, whether it's the news, whether it's other forms of art and culture, whether it's other films that are similar.
Yes,
and use all of that to you know, place the work that you're trying to encounter honestly and deal with on its own terms.
Yeah.
But in some context, you know.
Well, I think another central difference between somebody who's just going to the movies
yeah.
to be engaged or entertained is that they're going and they're just like soaking it in, watching, absorbing, and getting lost to some degree mm-hmm. in this world, the story. But as a critic, I guess when you go, you're looking, you're kind of into, there's a channel or some sort of process that's going on in your head where you're, I think, where you're saying what is looking for signals, looking for symbols, looking for meaning, you know, during it. So it's like there's like this thing going on, very conscious level, and as you, I think you said, open, you know, it's like, so you're going into it ready to look for things to write about.
Yeah.
So it absolutely. Changes your way of watching the movie, though. That's
well, I,
I'm not
I
saying
mean,
you can't
I mean,
also
maybe
have
it
that
does.
Other experience.
I think that I don't watch movies as innocently as I used to. I'm armed against them from the very beginning. I'm ready to defeat them, to feel like they're not doing something right. And so it's really nice when a movie is so expertly made and the experience is one that I find not just pleasing, but effortless. And I don't want to say that, you know, it's the cliche that, like, you know, you fall in love with the movies as a kid, and then, like, the great movies as you get older and more jaded are the ones that return you to childhood or something. That's not true for me. But I do think that the movies that really resonate with me feel like I'm effortlessly receiving great wisdom and great, you know, kind of like a deep-seated, almost physical joy from. If that makes any sense at all. I don't know if it does.
yeah. It's interesting. I don't want to criticize. I don't want to be a reviewer anymore. I've done a little bit of it. I don't think I'm particularly
right.
special doing
sure.
it. So I'm like, I wouldn't really go out of my way to read me. So therefore, why am I doing that? But so all I do as a programmer / screener is look for an emotional. Is just like enjoying it. Having an emotional connection, mm-hmm. like getting it on a very visceral, basic level, it's very different than thinking about how do I look at this analytically? I'm not looking at it analytically. So I like what that the other side of it, where it's if I'm connecting to the movie and if it holds up, that's all, you know.
Sure, but I mean, when you say the thing, when you say holds up, you're engaging with an. Like, you know, the analytical part of your brain.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, yes, I knew
no,
when you said that. That it was
like, no one watches a movie and doesn't.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Movies are language.
Something feels
and you have
wrong,
to analyze
right?
them
yeah,
in
yeah.
order to
you can, some people are good
get
squelch,
anything from them.
Yeah, you can
you know?
Squelch it to some degree. There'll some small flaws, but...
and
yeah.
what's so fascinating is that we're actually all taught to analyze movies, like, effortlessly. Like, no one actually teaches us to do it, but just through osmosis, almost. Through watching them and encountering the language within them, you... learn how to understand them. And it's different than reading, which you're actually taught to do, and which, as a child, it's very helpful in their earliest development to be read to and talked to. And children that aren't, mm-hmm. they're developmentally challenged often. And so I think that, you know, it's interesting because with the movies, there is none of that education, at least formally. But yet the language of movies speaks to, the you know, the broadly used languages that you find within movies, whether it's the continuity editing style of classical Hollywood that finds its way into the broad majority of narrative from, you know, Breaking Bad to Her to Prisoners to 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. or, you know, the verite style documentary, which has been a language that's very much kind of established. You know, I think that it's fascinating how easy it is for people to grasp that stuff. So but that said, I also think that there are other more formally ambitious types of things, whether it's, you know, a Brackage film or a Tree of Life or, you know, I'm Not There or, you know, any number of types of films that a lot of people will shut down in the face of them. You know, they refuse to analyze them or they don't have the analytical tools to feel comfortable encountering them. Mm-hmm. And because they think of the movies as an effortless experience or an experience that should be effortless, they won't analyze it.
Right.
And they'll say something derisively like, oh, well, this has to be analyzed.
No, but it goes even more basic than that, because even if there's a subtitle, they think that's that requires work.
Work, right.
It's not effortless. So therefore, that's why there's a certain level, certain population of people just won't go to films with subtitles.
Sure.
As you know, they just want the most effortless experience possible.
Although what's interesting is that so few subtitled films find their way to the, you know.
Well, yeah. Right.
30,000 movie screens.
To the movies. We can now say that because there's just way too few.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of Wong Kar-wai's these days.
Yeah. Did you see The Grandmaster?
I did.
I've tried to watch it twice on planes, and I haven't seen it yet because I shouldn't watch it on a plane. I should watch it here.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah, you should. Yeah. And you should watch, I guess, the original director's version, because there's like three versions of it apparently.
Yeah,
I think I saw the American cut, which was fine for my purpose. I just wanted to see it so I could talk to him about it and Tony Leung, and that was fun.
That sounds fun.
It was. They were both such great, interviewees or whatever guests, and I should. It's interesting because I've really stepped up the whole marketing and the whole. Like I've kind of gotten now onto another level in the last month or two, especially where I'm turning my attention towards ramping up awareness of the show and really making an effort. Brought somebody on to help with getting sponsors, brought somebody on to do social media, and I'm like, man, I did not take nearly enough advantage of that Wong Kar-wai. That should have gotten a lot more. Like at the moment, it should have gotten a lot more listeners. I should have a lot more awareness that show was there. You know, they're just putting it up on Facebook and then saying, "Well, there, I've marketed it." You know,
pity.
Yes and no. I mean, it's all good. You know, it's part of my archive. It's part of my experience, and I'm learning. You know, it's a good thing. We can find your writing on the new inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And also continued articles in Filmmaker Magazine. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned one other.
And I have an essay in Plus One.
Which people can find in your local popular bookstore, probably independent bookstores, my guess, although I don't know. Maybe
it's in Barnes & Noble.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. You can also read it online, the Betsy essay. Okay. It is now.
But support bookstores. You know, it's always the first.
Big party on January 4th. N plus one issue launch party.
Oh, nice. Okay.
It'll be a good time.
Are you inviting me?
Everyone's invited.
Where is this located?
It's somewhere in Soho. If you go to their website, I'm sure it's on their little feed.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They throw notorious parties, though.
Oh, is that true?
Yes. Gawker has written about
their parties. Therefore, it must be.
Yeah, they're
lampshade will be worn. I don't want me to put you on the spot, but I do feel like I didn't do a good job this year, as you know, about bringing anybody on to talk about Best Of. And it's not like we have to do that. I did a little bit of it in my last show with Al Mazelson. I put him on. I said, Al, tell me your top.
You want to hear my top movies of the year?
Do you have them in mind?
Yeah, I voted in the IndieWire Critic Poll.
Oh, okay, very good.
Again, I think it's fifth or sixth year I voted. And I have another listed Hammer and Nail as well, which is, you know, sub-million-dollar movies only. But
I'm interested in...
I mean, we can just talk about some of my, the stuff I've encountered that I really loved. In terms of commercially opening stuff, I mean, I think the post-Tenny Bruss Lux, the Carlos Regattas movie, was the most powerful thing I saw all year. I saw it twice. I saw it in Poland late last year, and then I saw it again.
Is Regattas, you said?
Yes, Regattas.
Yeah, right, Regattas. Okay.
I saw it in film form again when it opened here commercially. It's just a towering masterpiece. Uh-huh. And very different than his other films, and yet in some ways very similar.
Uh-huh.
I just think it's inventing its own aesthetic from the ground up, and yet it's completely readable, and yet it's mysterious.
Uh-huh.
He's just a beguiling and fascinating filmmaker. and that movie, which, you know, I mean, I could give spoilers and stuff, but I don't know if I should. One should just know if they haven't seen it. It's about a Mexican bourgeois couple and their children who live in a rural part of Mexico and their relationship with various laborers and not as neighbors, fortunate people in the area and the devil. And about half of it looks like it was shot with drunk goggles in front of the lens.
And another, maybe? A few or whatever?
Gravity, I think, was near the top of my list. It was number three. Mm-hmm. You know, so it speaks for itself in terms of how unusual and awe-inspiring, childlike awe-inspiring that experience is.
Right.
Of watching that film. I watched it on an illegal stream in this room.
Really?
And it was still awe-inspiring.
And without 3D.
Yeah.
Experience.
12 Years a Slave was number two for me. Mm-hmm. You know, a very visceral and powerful movie. A movie that's, you know, stays with you. Searing investigation of what it was like to be enslaved in America.
We don't see a lot of those stories.
We do increasingly. We've seen a number of them. You know, early in the year, I wrote an essay about Django Unchained. And it's fascinating how those films kind of speak to each other in a way.
Yeah. But,
you know, did you hear they're redoing Roots?
Huh?
They're redoing Roots. They're going to remake Roots.
I thought I heard that.
What an awful idea, right?
It is an awful idea.
Terrible idea. Number four.
We're going back to the sports. It's not a redo. It's a reimagining. That's what people keep using when they do a verse version of the original.
Man. The movie I identified, the character I identified most with in the cinema all year.
Yeah.
Last year was Magic Mike. Or the title character Magic Mike.
Channing Tatum
character. In any film this year, it had to be Frances. Greta Gerwig's Frances and Frances Ha.
Frances Ha.
I was just absolutely ready to hate that film walking in. I don't know why. Maybe because I'm not a big fan of mumblecore movies. I've always found Greta Gerwig to be an interesting performer, even in really lousy movies like Lola Versus or something. But
some of the Swanberg films. Yeah, that was pretty weak film. Or even Nights,
you know, some of the Swanberg films are not so good. Or, you know. But nonetheless, you know, I've always found her to be interesting. And but in this, I thought she was just absolutely superlative. And I found the circumstance to be invested with verisimilitude and good humor and yet a seriousness, and the filmmaking to be, you know, magnificently executed, just flawlessly, kind of borrowing from the French New Wave,
and from
a lot of things.
But
nonetheless, I think, you know, doing it in a really show-stopping kind of way.
I just imagine you, when you reference the film, you'd be running down, Bedford Avenue, listening to like mid-80s David Bowie.
I do that a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Lou Reed recently, too.
It doesn't. I don't know if it lends itself as much.
No, I don't think
Dirty
so.
Dirty Boulevard or.
Lends itself quite well.
Yeah.
What else made my list? Prisoners, the Denis Villeneuve. I thought that was a superior thriller. An oversimplification of her beauty.
Yeah.
Terrence Nance's film, which I think is a highly unique film. Much like Post Tenebras Lux, it's kind of building its own cinema from the ground up.
Terrence is a neighbor.
Terrence is a neighbor, Bed-Stuy resident. We should have him on the show.
I've had him on twice.
I'm sure. Well, there you go. Okay. Yeah.
But not
we should
say,
do a special Bed-Stuy edition. Sure. Just Bed-Stuy filmmakers. You know, so it's funny. It was a really great.
What else we have on?
It was a really great year in Bed-Stuy filmmaking and filmmaking here in the neighborhood. Another film that made my top 10 was Shaka King's Newly Weeds, which is a criminally underseen film.
Yeah.
But, you know, it may
hard
win.
To market that one, though. That's why. I mean, I know.
It's a terrible title.
I think it's bullshit.
Well, you could say that about every black movie.
I don't think
movie,
it's
right?
even a bad. Well, it's a
I guess
title
black
that
movies are hard to market.
You would think it's a silly comedy.
Hard to finance. And
yeah. It sounds like a.
It's a
like,
terrible title.
It's a terrible title for the movie that it is. But
yes.
I don't think it's a terrible title for another movie. I think
right.
it's funny. But it doesn't represent what it is. It's actually not a silly comedy. It's actually much more of a. You know, a dramatic film in some ways, but you know, there's plenty of comedy.
They're not even married.
Well,
in the film,
newlyweds.
It's just like a bad pun.
Right,
pun is bad. Shaka will be heard from this awards season.
Okay, are you talking about like
that's all
the
I can
Spirit
say.
Awards? Or are
that's
you
all
about?
I have to say.
Okay, that must mean something as far as this.
It might. Who knows? Number ten was a really. Controversial pick for me, just amongst the few people who I showed my list to as I was kind of concocting it, which was The Conjuring.
Oh, okay, yes.
By James Wan.
James Wan film. It's a horror film.
Yes.
About a family along the lines of an Amityville.
Wildly successful film.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it made like $300 million.
Well, this is a, I mean, internationally, this guy is a huge, yeah, huge name.
But I just think that, again, it's a traditional film, not unlike Prisoners, is, you know, working within a certain genre and a certain kind of construct of what we expect to get out of that genre. But it's just absolutely magnificent filmmaking. And it's such that, although I rarely find myself frightened at the movies, and especially in a very kind of conventional haunted house movie with a bunch of stars I've seen in numerous other films, I was pretty shaken.
I was scaredest, not in the, or had the most reaction, not to the haunted house, but to the, you know, the Ghostbusters, if I can refer to the couple of ghosts. No, but there's the couple, which are played by
Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson.
Thank you. You're faster.
You know, I know a guy who actually is a ghost hunter in Ohio, who didn't want to see the movie with me when I was home there this summer, because he apparently has met the couple.
Oh, geez.
Because they're it's apparently a true story.
It's the same couple. Didn't they look into the, is it the Amityville house? Or was
they
it,
might have been the Amityville couple.
There was some connection in there.
But I can't remember their names.
It doesn't matter. But the point is, I found nearly their room, attractive. The room in the house was, to me, that was the scary.
Oh, absolutely.
The room.
The way that he frames a lot of those moments, I mean, it's a very kind of mise-en-scene heavy, wide-angle lens heavy kind of movie. I mean, it has a rhythm that's unusual for those kinds of films.
Yeah. I remember like early 70s horror films.
Yeah.
That, you know, in American.
And there's no CGI. Films. There's no. Right. I mean, it's not like going out of his way to scare you. You know, I mean, in the way that I think traditional horror movies of this era do. And so, yeah, no, I thought it was really interesting.
And then, on the your Hammered and Nail list, you want to mention a few of those?
Those movies aren't as good. I don't know.
Well, but still. And we want to support
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
They're too cheap to be good, right?
Francis Ha was on there.
Oh, is that under $1 million? Because you said it was on your IndieWire list.
I think that we included
it. But they don't have a
I think that we included
amount.
It. I don't know if that...
But
I,
also, do they...
I can't imagine they made that movie for under $1 million, but we saw fit to include that. I don't know why. Because the logic of Hammer and Nail sometimes escapes me. But nonetheless...
The spirit of an under $1 million is usually the way they...
Yeah, I guess. I guess it's in the spirit. It's in the spirit. Mother of George made my list.
Yes.
Magnificent movie.
Eric Dussault's movie.
Yeah.
Is it Eric?
Andrew.
Yeah. Thank you. I knew it was wrong.
Magnificent movie.
Andrew's.
Certainly Newly Weeds made the list of oversimplification. There was a lot of overlap with the other list in that way. I don't know. It's been a while since.
It's good to know. We have actually a lot of overlap. I did it like an informal thing on my
last What was your best undistributed?
Oh, I don't know that I came up with it. Let me.
For me, it had to have been. I saw a really magnificent undistributed film. But See You Next Tuesday by Drew Tobia is just a stunning film.
Okay.
It's a real shame it doesn't have a higher profile. World premiered at the Chicago Underground Film Festival. I saw it in Memphis where it won a couple prizes. And it's a really special film. It's about a pregnant white woman in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Who theme of the night? Who works at the Key Foods on Lafayette Avenue?
Wait a minute, I did see this
one.
Wait, who directed this again?
A guy named Drew Tobia.
Who introduced this to me? Is she having screaming fights on the street with her mother?
Yeah.
I saw that. Shocking to me, but I did see that. No, it wasn't Rob. Who was it? Somebody introduced it to me. Oh, it was Jason.
Chlorophyne?
Yeah, Chlorophyne.
He's the producer.
He's the producer, right? Yeah. I couldn't watch it. I don't know what you had a better. I have a lot of tolerance, but there was so much vile, angry spewing.
Oh, I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah,
it was
I didn't have that reaction. Jason really tried to. He, you know, I talked to him about it. I said, Jason, I just couldn't. I couldn't do it. And I have I do have a threshold for a lot of this stuff, but I forgot I did see that.
Yeah.
Or
I liked it.
Two-thirds of it.
Well. Yeah, you know, Let the Fire Burn, Gut Renovation.
Thank you. Let the Fire... Oh, I left out... okay.
You know.
Yeah, I know you were a big advocate of Gut Renovation.
Yeah.
But Let the Fire Burn, I was trying to get Jason Oster on the...
I've yet to meet him in person, although I've written about him.
Yeah, yeah. I've been trying to get him on. When I saw that, it was almost arbitrary that I chose that documentary from the distributor I wanted. I think it was First Run Films.
First Zeitgeist, I think, maybe.
Anyway, I pursued trying to get him on, and just because it was very, you may be right. I mean, I did it through Adam Walker at Film Forum, but I waited a little too long, and I was too busy, and then I watched it, and I was like, oh, it's such a rare to see a completely archival experience that is just so powerful.
Yeah.
And I somewhat under, of course, appreciated, though it I'm glad to see that it has made a bunch of lists, at least. So I know the critics saw it, and maybe it'll, have a life. But that was a great. So I would still have the guy on. I mean, what a great documentary. But thanks for reminding me about that, because I should have brought that up.
You're welcome.
Just kind of going to my intro last week.
Why they pay me the big bucks.
That's why they pay you the big bucks. Great. Well, thank you very much.
This has been FilmWatch Radio, guys. Thanks for listening. I'm Brandon Harris, here with Adam Chartoff. Or maybe Adam Chartoff is here with me, but he's in my house, so...
I am. And thank you for inviting me over. I've been to a couple of your places. I'd say this is by far coziest, comfortable.
I think so.
Yeah. There's a projector, which is fitting. And I walked in and Red River was projected on the wall. I like that.
We have our own Howard Hawks class here.
Uh-huh.
That's great. Peter Bogdanovich comes by in an ascot.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Brandon.
Thank you.
Everybody's going out and having fun. I'm a fool for staying home and having none. I can't get over.
Should really take a moment and thank everybody now that I'm thinking about it. I want to thank my friends at Rooftop Films. You know who you are, Dan and Mark, Kristen and Jen, Kate and Elise, and all the other guys there. I want to thank a few other people that I don't normally get to thank, but who have helped me over the last year, including Michael Rodriguez. And I also want to thank Stephanie Anderis and Betty Kaplan. I'd like to thank, more recently, Harrison Bender, Eva Arena, and Herbert Gamble for all his technical support earlier this summer, and also Theodore Belukas, who's been a, and Kristen McCracken, both of whom have either guest-hosted or co-hosted several episodes of this podcast. So I want to thank you, I want to thank everybody, but I really essentially want to thank you, the listening audience, because without you guys, I wouldn't be able to do this podcast. And you know it's true. So thank you for subscribing and supporting the show. It means so much to me. This is podcast is my passion project, I guess you could say. And, I'm very dedicated to only getting a better show done for you in 2014. So... guys, that's it for 2013. This is your host, Adam Chartoff. You've been listening to FilmWatch Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T.